This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's really hard. The very first thing that folks are trying to do is initially offer psychological first aid, which is right, just a safety, stability, find out what their immediate needs are, how can they help contact other people for
That's
them.
That's University of Mary Hardin Baylor Associate Professor Brenda Morton on how disaster survivors in Libya and Morocco are dealing with trauma. Details coming up. Also, Egypt's foreign minister says his government is working closely with partners to negotiate an end to the Sudan conflict. And the United States is temporarily stopping assistance to Gabon after the military took charge. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, on his first visit to Africa, met first with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud in Djibouti and praised him for making impressive progress in the fight against al-Shabaab militants. He also met Djibouti's president and defense minister, thanking them for hosting the United States' primary base in Africa. Then he headed to Nairobi. He signed a defense agreement with the Kenyan government. And now he is in Angola's capital, Luanda. Earlier, I spoke with our VOA Pentagon correspondent, Carl Babb, who is traveling with Secretary Austin. So, you are in Luanda. What is the mission in Angola for the Secretary?
So, the Secretary has had a very particular focus in Angola, very different from Djibouti and also from Kenya. Angola and the United States do not have that close ties, and they have been working very hard over the last several months to bring the two countries closer together. And so what the Secretary has done today, he met with the President. He also met with the Minister of Defense, looking for ways that they can help that military cooperation increase, including using U.S. equipment. They would like to see Angola start using U.S. equipment and training more with U.S. forces. He gave a speech here in Angola and made some very interesting points. He was calling out the Wagner Group and Russia during this speech, saying that the United States will never take partnership for granted. The people of Africa deserve to chart their own sovereign path. Then Africa deserves better than outsiders trying to tighten their grip on the continent and autocrats selling cheap guns, pushing mercenary forces like the Wagner Group and depriving grain from hungry people all around the world, of course, alluding to Russia preventing grain from coming outside of Ukraine at the moment.
So, Carla, your overall assessment about the Secretary's first trip to Africa, starting with Djibouti, tell us what you thought about the whole thing.
This first tour of Africa has been a very interesting experience. A lot of news made, a lot of important drop-offs, and a lot of important points made along the way, especially talking with the Somali president. He pointed out that there had been more progress against al-Shabaab, the biggest terror group, the biggest threat to the United States in Africa, over the past year than the past 5 years combined. And he said that the United States needs to continue to work with its Somali partners, and he hopes that the other countries around Africa will also help Somalia in their fight against al-Shabaab. Then he went to Kenya, where they signed an agreement, a five-year defense agreement, so they could plan to further cooperate military to military, and included in their discussions was confirmation that Kenya is going to be sending a military police to Haiti and that the U.S. is going to provide $100 million in support of these Kenyan military police because the United States says Kenya has been a leader in peacekeeping missions across the globe. And finally, here in Angola, the U.S. is looking to build and strengthen ties here. And honestly, it was a very personal time for the Secretary of Defense. He has today visited the slavery museum in Luanda, slaves that were taken from Angola to the United States centuries ago now have a common thread, he says. He said, I am a child of America's segregated South. I grew up in a time of legalized racist segregation in America, and I stand here today in Africa as America's first black Secretary of Defense. He was telling Angola that democracy may not be perfect, but democracy is the way to grow, not with military coups, not with autocrats.
Carol Babb, our Pentagon correspondent in Luanda, briefing us on the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's visit. Thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me. You're welcome.
Two months after a coup ousted Niger's pro-Paris president, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that France would withdraw its ambassador from the West African country, followed by the French military contingent by the end of this year. Niger's military leaders welcomed the decision as a step towards sovereignty and demanded a timetable for the military withdrawal. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with David Monda, professor of international relations at City New York University.
Number one, that France has found itself diplomatically, strategically, and politically in an isolated position. Macron found that he was not getting any support for his ambassador, Sylvain Ité, to stay in Niger from ECOWAS. And neither did the United States come to his aid in terms of speaking for the ambassador to stay. So diplomatically, Paris was isolated. But I also think, on the other hand, we then see the stronger hand of the military regime in Niger in terms of reasserting Nigerian sovereignty and rejecting the hand of France within the country, at least officially. And also, let's not forget that the Niger government also got into an informal alliance with both Mali and Burkina Faso in terms of a tripartite defense alliance. So even strategically, when you think of how the Niger administration played its cards in getting to a pact with Mali and Burkina Faso to isolate France and also to get ECOWAS not to intervene, not to condemn the Nigerian regime, I think France really found itself isolated, but this really gives Niger an upper hand, not only politically, but also diplomatically.
The French president has repeatedly spoken of making a historic change to France's post-colonial imprint in Africa, but analysts say Paris is losing influence across the continent, especially in the face of a growing Chinese and Russian presence. From a strategic point of view, is Africa leaning towards Russia and China?
Yes, the Chinese and Russian footprint is increasing on the continent. But let's not forget that France has a colonial history in Africa that goes back over 150 years. France still has 1,500 troops in Niger. France has military bases in Ayoro, in Oualam, and also in Niamey. And also, let's not forget, France is in partnership with the United States, which has one of the largest drone bases in the world in Agadez, in Niger. So France and its allies still have significant influence. And the reason I say this is, even though Russia seems to have increasing influence in the Sahel, and in particular in Niger, the Russians don't seem to have replaced the French in terms of the security narrative. As France has withdrawn its military involvement in Niger, we see the jihadist attacks in the last 6 months have actually gone up. So the Wagner group, which is supposed to have stepped in to fill that French vacuum, doesn't really seem to have replaced the French completely in terms of the security situation in Niger. So there's a lot of very domestic dynamics within Niger, with Russia trying to increase its influence in Niger. But there's also a lot of domestic politics in Russia and its war in Ukraine, which limits its capacity to expand its influence in Niger, particularly when we remember that Niger is a former French colony. And even though it seems France's influence is waning, but France has been in that region for over 150 years. Linguistically, culturally, militarily, politically, France still have a huge influence.
So how would the French withdrawal impact the counter-terrorism efforts in the Sahel?
Should the 1,500 French troops withdraw, the bigger question then will be, number one, what will America's response be? will the Nigerian administration in Niamey also demand the U.S. drone base in Niamey and in Agadez? Will they also demand that remove this troop out of Niger? Secondly, if Niger was not able to defeat the jihadists before the French intervened, how will Niger be able to deal with these jihadists now that the French are leaving? We know Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. Niger's military just does not have the capacity to deal with the jihadists. Who will fill the power vacuum once the French leave? If the jihadists continue to become stronger, then Niger might be forced to either rely on the Wagner group or to renegotiate with the French some terms for the French to re-engage in terms of fighting with the jihadists. But I really think it's a dangerous position for Niger right now, because with the French leaving, there'll be a power vacuum. Exactly how will the current military administration sustain not only its economic interests with sanctions from ECOWAS, but how will it reinforce its strategic and security interests now with the French pulling out of Niger?
And that was David Monda, professor of international relations at City New York University, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Egypt's foreign minister Sami Hassan Shoukry says his government is working closely with partners such as Saudi Arabia, the United States, and the African Union to try to negotiate an end to the conflict in Sudan. The fighting between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed thousands of civilians and forced more than 3 million people to flee their homes. Tens of thousands of them have crossed into Egypt. In an interview with VOA's Peter Cloete, Foreign Minister Shoukry discusses the Sudan conflict and efforts to end it.
Well, we have been applying our relationships to our Sudanese brethren, our contacts with all of the participants, whether in the military or in the civilian component, primarily in the military, to instill the importance of reaching a ceasefire in dealing with the humanitarian consequences of this conflict, and in moving towards a broader dialogue that can chart a roadmap for a future and lead to elections and a stable and a unified government for Sudan that preserves the interests of its people, it preserves its territorial integrity, and provides the traditional role of Sudan to play an active role within the context of its African association to Eastern Africa, to the African Union. We continue to do so. President Sisi initiated the summit of the neighbors of Sudan. We have met as foreign ministers in N'Djamena to formulate a roadmap that has been endorsed, and we met here on the margins of the GA to operationalize that roadmap after the heads of state have endorsed it. I hope that those efforts, and they will address the security perspective, the humanitarian perspective, and the political perspective, each of the neighboring countries utilizing its deep relationships with various sectors of the Sudanese political entities, the military, the civilian component, to attract them to see the importance of ending this conflict, of providing the support to the Sudanese people, and expanding the dialogue.
At this ongoing UN General Assembly, the head of the Sudan National Army called on the international community to designate the RSF as a terrorist organization. If this is done, will this help the process to resolve the ongoing conflict and to bring peace, like you said, Egypt is trying to rally around people to solve?
We are concentrating on ending the military confrontation and providing a format for political discussions between those concerned to reach an understanding that relieves the consequences and pressures on the Sudanese people. That is our main focus, in collaboration with the other formats that are involved in the issues related to Sudan. It's important also to maintain the structures of the institutions of governance, the legitimacy and the national state entities as the viable protector of the interests of the Sudanese people. I think we have seen the experience in our region of countries that have imploded and that have fragmented and do not have institutions of government that can represent the country and provide services to the people and to their citizens.
That was Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Hassan Shoukry. He spoke with my colleague Peter Cloti recently on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. A note on African News Tonight's show at 1600 UTC. We had Mr. Shoukry's name incorrect. We apologize for the error. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Unions representing Nigeria's government workers say they will go on strike again starting next week. They are demanding pay raises and protesting austerity measures of the newly elected government. The Nigeria Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress represent hundreds of thousands of government workers across key sectors. They say they will stop work for an indefinite period starting Tuesday. The Associated Press says it will be the third strike in less than 2 months. The strike, called, adds pressure on Nigerian President Bola Tinubu, whose elimination of fuel subsidies has increased the cost of living for more than 210 million people. Consumers are also grappling with surging inflation, which hit an 18-year high of 25.8% in August. Post-traumatic stress is an everyday challenge for thousands of Libyans who survived the wall of water that hit the coastal city of Derna from Storm Daniel on September 10th. Thousands were killed and many bodies are still trapped underneath the rubble or lost at sea. Many Moroccans are also suffering from the trauma caused by the 6.8 magnitude quake that hit September 8th, killing nearly 3,000 people and leveling entire villages. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Brenda Morton, associate professor at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor in Belton, Texas, an expert on trauma, if people are receiving psychological support in Libya and Morocco.
I'm not seeing necessarily that there's a lot of help coming in yet, but it does sound like that neighbors are helping neighbors kind of idea, and folks are definitely trying to take care of each other and kind of come together as a community. But I wasn't seeing yet this morning that there were necessarily organizations that had entered to be able to offer some emergency assistance.
I know that the ICRC gets into these places like where there's a disaster like this, and they try to offer some kind of help. Do you know if they have people there that try to help with the trauma end of it?
I don't. I do know that when these types of things occur, it's really hard. The very first thing that folks are trying to do is initially offer psychological first aid, which is right, just safety, stability. Find out what their immediate needs are, how can they help contact other people for them, those types of things. And that really will happen first in that first kind of wave of assistance before we get into things like what type of mental health help do folks need. A lot of times folks don't really know yet what they need because they're still in that space of fear and flight and unable to really think through any more than, you know, what the immediate, what I can see around me.
It makes me think of personal relatives when somebody very close to them that they love died and it was not expected and they're just in shock for more than a day, for days. Is that what we're talking about here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a track to this. So you can look at it in terms of like eight stages or phases of going of reactions to disasters. And the first like 1 to 3 days are kind of this period where like as people are coming together as a community, you're going to hear stories about different heroics and folks coming in and doing just amazing things to help out each other in a community. And they're assessing the damage and trying to figure out where they're at with what they need, those types of things. And that's going to take a few days to do that. But then what we're really going to get into is how do we work through the grief? How do we start to think about rebuilding? What would it take to rebuild? Can we rebuild where we are? Is it safe to rebuild where we are? Do I want to rebuild where I was before? And that can take a few years to really figure that out.
Yeah. And like you're talking about, like these people don't know the answers to those questions. And it's kind of, I would imagine the fear of the unknown is adding to their trauma.
Absolutely. You know, reading through some of these stories as well, you know, the people were reporting like, we always have rains, right? This is not out of the ordinary for us to have this rain hit, but they didn't, there was no reason for them to think that it could breach these dams or that this would occur. And so thinking about in the future, you know, once even years out, the way that they will respond when there is heavy rains coming in the forecast, you can only imagine, right, that they're going to go back to this point in time where they're thinking about what did that look like and feel like, and gosh, I need to maybe do this or that, or they're just looking at things very differently than they had in the past.
And the earthquake victims in Morocco, what about them? They have trauma as well, but I would imagine different kind of trauma because in those first few days after the initial quake, they weren't even going back inside.
Absolutely. And then also thinking about those aftershocks, right, that occur. And so, again, I mean, these two are similar in that you've got some people that were saying, like, hey, we get these small little earthquakes or little tremors. Just as Libby would say, well, we get rain, and we're used to that. And when we think about Morocco, now that we've had this huge, huge earthquake, again, you know, they're going to be looking at similar things. Do we rebuild? How do we put our life back together?
That's Brenda Morton, associate professor at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor. She spoke with VOA's Carol Van Dam from the U.S. state of Texas. The United States is temporarily stopping assistance to Gabon after the military took charge last month. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement the government is pausing certain foreign assistance programs benefiting the government of Gabon while the U.S. evaluates the unconstitutional intervention by members of the country's military. Blinken said the United States was maintaining diplomatic and consular operations in the oil-rich Central African country. Gabonese military leaders on August 30th overthrew Ali Bongo Ondimba just as he was proclaimed the winner of an election widely criticized for irregularities. The military installed as Prime Minister opposition leader Raymond Ndong Sima, who, in an address to the United Nations last week, promised to take steps to hold new elections and called on the West not to condemn the coup without nuance. And with that...
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Bob Bass, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.